You're listening to episode 19 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and in this episode, we will be talking about GNU, and Linux, and file choosers, and CSS, and archives. Lots of interesting things, so let's get started. First thing I should mention is that I just got back from Ogcast Planet Live. Ogcast Planet Live is, let's call it a not-a-con, or an un-con. It's a technical convention that was basically started by a group of people who, I think we were at Southeast Linux Fest at the time. It might have been Ohio, but I think it was Southeast. And we were sitting around thinking, gee, isn't it great to just be sitting around with the people that you're normally talking to on IRC, but in real life? So it's a real live IRC conversation. Let's bill it that way. So we were sitting around, and we kind of thought that it might be a good idea to have a very informal convention or conference between people who work in the industry or are really, really excited about Linux or whatever, get together and just chat. I mean, if it ends up being about Linux for an hour and then something else for another hour, that's okay. The idea was a get-together, a lug meeting, I guess, of a bunch of people from different places. So I don't exactly have data on where everyone came from, but I know that it was held in Philadelphia. A couple of people came out from Pittsburgh. A few people came out from Indiana. One person came all the way from Kansas. There was another guy from New Jersey. It was a really cool little get together in person IRC session. It was great. We had a lot of great conversation, a lot of great food, and it was a lot of fun. So if you get a chance to go to Ogcast Planet Live 2.0 or 1.0, I don't know if this was 0 or 1, then take that opportunity next year. It was definitely worth a trip out there. It was a lot of fun, and got to meet a lot of people, some of whom I've seen a lot before at other conventions, and some people whom I'd not met at all. So very cool. Very, very fun. Okay, so now let's get on to some listener feedback really quick. Most of this show is pre-recorded, but I'm dipping in with some more recent content here just because I can. And let's see. Harley Inbody emailed me, and he has been emailing me a lot lately, I guess, about Git, and which is apropos because actually next weekend there is a technical convention in my own town that I'm giving another Git talk at, so this is all very good. But this website that Harley found is called getready.com, and it is full of, I would say, task-based tips on Git, meaning that it's not a tutorial. Tutorials are great every now and again, and they take you step by step, and it's kind of a walkthrough, and that's one model that works very well, but it's a very specific, you have to be at a certain stage to get anything out of a tutorial, right? I mean, if you're already using Git every day, then a tutorial on how to use Git doesn't really usually do you a whole lot of good. At some point, you cross that barrier of, okay, what is this thing called Git, and how do I use it? And now you're into the area of, okay, I use Git every day, now how do I do this new thing that I've heard about, or what new cool thing have I not learned yet that I could maybe start taking advantage of? This site has a bunch of tips geared at beginning, intermediate, and advanced level users, and it really just kind of, you can drop in, you can click on something that looks interesting, read up on a new trick, and suddenly you have some new thing that you can do with Git and maybe make your workflow more efficient or whatever. So great, great tip. Thank you very much, Harley, for that. I also got an email from Ken Fallon, and Ken says that Emacs is very useful, is very cool. He still believes that Vim is, I guess, the one that people really ought to, you ought to learn, I guess, enough about Vim to be able to use it, because as I myself said, I believe on the episode that I was talking about this stuff, Vim is just the one, or even VI more specifically, is the one that you're going to find no matter what on a server. Although that's actually not entirely true. I've actually encountered some installs that didn't even have Vi. It was like literally ed. That was pretty bizarre. I'm pretty sure that must have been a bad install. Not one of mine. But yeah, so that was Ken Fallon's feedback. Thank you very much, Ken. And now let's continue on to the next topic. Unarchiving, RPM, and Debian packages. This is something that I think we probably all stumble across every now and again. Probably not all that often, granted, but it's something that I know that I come across, well actually, okay, honestly, I come across very frequently now, because lately I've been doing more Slack build work than really ever before. And part of the Slack build stuff is to take maybe a package that has been rolled into an RPM or a deb and unpackaging it and then repackaging it for Slackware. And it sounds like it's a cheat, and it sort of is, but in some cases, that's the only way you're going to get something, right? Like, very recently, in fact, there's this application, which was news to me, but it's called Spotify, and apparently it's like a music player of some sort, like a social music player. And Spotify, I really don't know much about it, but here's what I'm gathering. Spotify is a closed source application, but it's friendly towards the Linux community in terms of helping people package up the application itself. So on the Slack build mailing list, someone mentioned that Spotify was no longer working and that they had emailed the Slack build maintainer with the bug and said, hey, could you update this? And they tried to update it themselves, but it was a little bit beyond their capability or their scripting ability to kind of figure out what exactly needed to happen. So I thought, well, that sounds kind of like an interesting problem. So I'm going to just try my hand at it, just for fun. So I downloaded the Slack build that had already existed and kind of looked into this thing. Again, at this point, I had no idea what Spotify was. So I looked at the script and saw that what it was doing was pulling a .deb file from this Spotify web page where the downloads are and unpackaging the .deb file and then grabbing the Spotify, everything that's in that .deb file, and then distributing it across the Slackware system so that instead of doing a .deb install, you're just taking those files and putting them into the places where they need to be, which is all really RPMs and .debs do anyway. I mean, aside from, like, dependency resolution. But, I mean, that's all that's happening, right? When you're installing software, you're just taking these things and you're either compiling the components and then putting the components where they go, or you're taking pre-compiled components and putting them on your system where they need to go. It's like an overlay almost. So there's a couple of applications like that. There's Spotify. There's, I think a couple of people do that for LibreOffice because, I mean, that's huge. You don't really want to compile that, do you? Of course not. I think a couple of people may do that for, like, Blender. I think sometimes I do. It depends on what mood I'm in or how easy it is to make that iteration of Blender compile from source, which kind of varies. So yeah, a couple of them do that. And maybe for your own purposes, maybe there are times where you want to unpackage a .deb file or a .rpm file to just learn about packaging or maybe you need to debug it. Maybe it's not working for you on your system. So whatever your purpose, there are ways to unarchive .deb and .rpm files, and it's not difficult at all. So to unarchive a .deb file, you probably should first make a directory. For instance, make dir foo underscore deb, and then move into that directory that you've created and grab the .deb file that you want to unarchive. If you haven't already, or if you have, then copy that .deb file into this directory that you are now in. So cd foo underscore deb, and then let's just say wget space http://example.com/download/foo.deb. Okay, so now we've got a .deb file. The unarchiving of the .deb file will be ar, that's like archive or something, ar space dash p as in Peter, space foo.deb, space foo.tar.gz pipe tar zxv. Okay, so what are we doing there? Well, we are unarchiving, or we are translating the archive of the .deb into a tar.gz archive, and then we are untarring that archive into the current directory. So in the end, you'll see things like /usr or /etsy or /opt, you know, whatever that .deb file contained. And usually it's a miniature little file system, as it were, right? So if you look in USR, you'll probably see then a bin. And then if you look in that bin, then you'll see the application that you just downloaded. In this case, it would probably be foo. And then maybe you'd look in /etsy and maybe /default and then /foo.conf. And then maybe you'd see a /usr or a /usr/doc, and there would be the documentation. So all of those components are kind of nestled into all of their little folders that, in theory, when you installed that .deb, would be overlaid onto your system. But now they're all contained in this one foo underscore deb folder that you've created, and now you've just unarchived it into this one sort of one location. So be a little bit careful with .debs. They are essentially tar bombs, right? I mean, if you unarchive them, they will sprinkle all of their files all over whatever your current directory is. So it's important to make a directory for yourself so that you keep it all contained. But I mean, that's it. That's how you unarchive a .deb file. For RPM, as far as I know, you need RPM to CPIO. That is RPM2CPIO. So what that is it's a little application, a little utility that actually ships with RPM. So if you go to rpm.org, then you can download it if you don't have it already. So like if you're on a Debian-based system, for instance, and you want to do this, then you will have to install RPM, or at least RPM2CPIO. But don't freak out. It's not a bad thing. You don't actually have to use RPM. You just have to download it and have it on your system so that you get this RPM2CPIO utility. That's actually, Slackware actually ships. Not a lot of people know this. Slackware actually ships with RPM. So as far as I know, you can't use RPM. I mean, I guess you could, but none of the RPMs that you would be using would be built for Slackware. So there'd probably be a bunch of errors in terms of like where things were going. It does have RPM on it, and then it's got the whole tool chain, like RPM2CPIO and the other RPM utilities, which I can't think of right now. Well, there's RPM2TGZ, but that's not part of the RPM distribution. But yeah, it's got it on there so that you can then manipulate RPMs. So that's all you would be doing. If you're on Red Hat or Fedora or CentOS or Scientific Linux or Magia or whatever, then you probably, you most certainly have RPM2CPIO already installed. So again, the initial process would be the same. You would make a directory, make dir foo underscore RPM. You would cd into foo underscore RPM, and you would wget the RPM that you want, or maybe you would yum get it, but not install, so download only. However you need to get this thing. So let's just do wget example.com/download/foo.rpm. Now you've got the RPM that you want to unarchive in your folder. So you're going to do an RPM2CPIO /foo.rpm and then redirect that to foo.cpio. So you've just, again, it's the same concept as the AR foo.deb or -p foo.deb to data dot or foo.tar.gz, because you're basically transcoding the archive into another kind of archive. So you've just you've turned the RPM into a CPIO archive, essentially. And then all you have to do from there is use CPIO to unarchive foo.cpio. So CPIO /i/(m/(d) as in delta, then redirect into that command foo.cpio. And you can look up the man page for CPIO to kind of get what all those flags mean. It's not that big of a deal. It's honestly, I have never used CPIO except for this process right here. And then a lot of times I'm not even doing that directly, but it's just like that incantation will unarchive the foo CPIO, which of course is the which is the translated RPM that you've created. So that's all you really need to do. Again, you will find it's a little bit like a tar bomb. It'll sprinkle all those files into your current directory, and which is why we made a foo underscore RPM directory, so that we contain all of that. But then you can go and poke through and look at all the different files that are included with that RPM. So it's really, really handy to be able to do this, especially if you're getting into packaging at all, because this way you can either learn what other people did to package up an application, or you can steal all of their work for your own Slack build or your own port or whatever you need to do. It's you know, in the spirit of free software, it's reusing someone else's hard work. But I mean, sometimes that's the only way to get the data that you need, because literally some applications, especially like the stuff that's not, I mean, if it's not free software, open source, where you can actually download the source code and compile it yourself, then a lot of times the only way they're distributing it for Linux is as a .deb or an RPM. And that's all you get. That's how you get that software for Linux. There's no tarball download. So that's what you get. So you have to unarchive it if you're not on a .deb or RPM system. There you go. That's how you do the unarchiving of .deb and RPM files. Okay, so that was about unarchiving RPM and .debs. I feel kind of like, since we're on the subject, a little bit more about tar might actually be kind of handy. A lot of us, in terms of tar, I mean, that's one of those, and I've said this before, that's one of those commands that I think a lot of us have very fond, and I'm using that word a little bit carefully, but fond memories of the tar command. It went back when we first started on Linux or Unix. It was one of those commands that you found yourself using every day, and yet for the life of you, you could never remember. Am I right? Or am I right? Admit it. I mean, I know for myself, I literally had a little notebook that I kept by my computer, and one of those pages was tar, how to create and how to extract, because I could just not remember it all. Especially since a lot of times, for some reason, people teach it to you. I guess historically, you did have to do this, but now, of course, you can do tar xf foo.tar.gz or bz2, and it'll just figure out what it needs to do. But I guess historically, you had to literally say tar xjf and then, you know, bz2 or whatever. So yeah, you had to actually specify. But and I'm glad I did learn it that way, because now that I'm creating my own tar balls more, I might do like a cjvf instead of a czvf. So it is kind of nice. But I mean, I don't know. It seems like tar is a very confusing command when you are first learning, because you just can't remember it. So a lot of us have only learned tar xvf foo.tar.asterisk, and that's it. That's what we know about tar. And maybe you know the tar command, create command, but did you know all the different commands on how to like extract just one file, or how to list the files without even bothering extracting? I'll admit, for myself, way too often I used to just do a tar xvf, some kind of archive, just so that I could see what was in the archive, and then my next step would be rm space dash rf that archive that I just unzipped, you know, or unarchived, uncompressed, extracted, whatever the term is. So it was a really sort of inefficient way. I mean, it worked, but it wasn't like the right way to list all the files in an archive. It's not like I really needed to do that. So let's go through a couple of commands. So creating a tar ball, of course, is just doing tar cvf foo.tar space foo, right? Because you're saying create verbosely the file foo.tar, and then you're giving the source of that is this folder foo, and that does it. That creates your tarball. Of course, you can also make that compressed archive using either gzip or bzip2 or a couple of other ones, but these are the two that I use a lot. Tar cjf would be a bz2, so you would be tar cjf foo dot, for instance, tbz space foo. That would create a tarred up foo that is then bzipped. Or you could do a tar czf for foo.tar.gz or tgz, however you want to abbreviate it, and then foo, and that would give you foo.tar.gz. So that's very handy. And of course, the common extensions are either tar.gz or .tgz for a tar gzip, or tar.bz2 or tbz for a bz2 compressed tar ball. Okay, so that's kind of the basic stuff. And then, like I already have told you, and you probably already know, xvf will get you the will extract those things, and it will do that. It will figure out what it needs to invoke, either a z or a j, in order to extract either a gzip or a bzip2, or even, in my experience, xz. So xvf is pretty much all purpose, like tar xvf. That'll unarchive anything that's been tar and compressed, in my experience so far. I'm sure there's an exception, but whatever. Okay, so now let's say that we have a tarball that already exists. It can't be compressed, but if it's just a tarball and it exists and you want to add something to that archive, that's, instead of a C for creating, instead of an X for extracting, it's R for, I don't know, adding. So it would be tar rvf foo.tar blah. So that would add the file blah to the archive foo.tar. So you don't have to untar foo and then drag and drop blah into foo and then retar foo. You can just do rvf or rf if you're not into the whole verbosity thing. You can also do that with a whole directory. So tar rvf foo.tar llamas, and that'll add the whole directory of llamas into foo.tar. No uncompressing and recompressing required. That's a handy one. I do that for not backups, but like collections of files that I consider sort of like archive. Well, yeah, I guess I consider and I keep them as archives, specifically for GNU World Order episodes. No real reason for me to keep them as viewable directories. I just archive the thing, and then when there's a new episode, on my backup hard drive for this stuff, I just tar RVF this episode into the GNU World Order archive. So that's how I do it, and it works. It works quite nicely. You can also view the files. This is a big one for me. View a list of files within a tarball. This is really good because, especially what I've been doing lately for Slack builds, when you download source code and you're trying to figure out what needs to go into your Slack build, I do this a lot for documentation, because the documentation stuff, I mean, there's the man page, maybe there's an info page, and then there's probably some other stuff like a README and an install and a to-do list and a news and a change log, all this other stuff that's kind of supposed to go into the Slack build because it was in the source code. So I'm always finding myself, you know, when I'm writing the Slack build, I'll be like, oh, what do I need? What other files do I need to add to this? And so I will do a tar TVF. So that's T as in, well, tar, really. So tar TVF foo.tar.bz2, for instance, and that lists in a very nice, pretty clear list what is in this tarball. So there might be some files, there might be some folders that also have files in them, and so it gives you a file tree, basically, of everything contained in that tarball. Very, very useful. And the cool thing about this, too, is that let's say you do have an archive of stuff, or maybe you have some source code and you've been messing around with the make file or something and you've screwed it up. You need to grab it from the source directory. But, I mean, again, you don't have to blow away the whole thing. You can just restore one file from an archive. So first you would do the tar TVF foo.tar.bz2, and then you could extract just one file from that. Let's say you needed the bar.info file from a tarball. So you could do a tar xvf, so same command there, foo.tar.bz2 space foo/bar.info. Now, how would you know where bar.info existed? Well, you would know because you just did a tar-tvf on foo.tar.bz2, and you would know that, yes, in the root directory of foo, or the base directory, I guess I should say, of foo, exists a file called bar.info. So you can, by telling tar the base folder and then the file name, or the base folders and the file name, along with your xvf, you're telling it to extract from this tarball this exact file. You just have to give it the exact path, which sounds phenomenally impossible until you realize that you can do a tar tvf and find out the exact path. So it's really, really easy to get just one file or folder, for that matter. You can just tell it to extract, you know, the foo/llamas folder, and it will extract that whole folder for you. And it's, you know, a lot easier sometimes than extracting the whole big thing, the whole big source directory. Or maybe it's not easier, but it's cleaner, you know? You have a lot less to sort of blow away in the end when you realize, wow, I've got like 5 copies of this source directory littered around my code directory. I need to kind of clean that stuff up. You can also extract multiple directories. So you could do tar xvf foo.tar.bz2 and extract foo/llamas, foo/bar, foo/baz, whatever. You can also even do, you can extract files using simple regex, which I say simple because I really don't know that much about it. I mean, regex. So you can do like a tar xvf foo.tar --wildcards --la --. And that would, of course, extract all the files within foo.tar-bz2 that, or foo.tar, whatever, that contain anything .la. I think .la is a... that's a library or something, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe I made that up. .so. Let's do it. .so. Point is regex. And that's it, really. That's how you do tar-ing. And another thing that I just now thought of, tar xvf foo.tar.bz2-C --bar. That will do. The --C is how you tell it to, I think it's probably like change directory, I imagine, but it's the destination. So if you want to extract a tarball that exists here in your current folder, but you want to send it off to some other folder, use the dash capital C command. It's like zip dash delta, but it's tar dash capital C. I use that on a weekly basis because that's I script a lot of installs for the place that I work, and so I'm very, very frequently untarring stuff into a very specific folder. So that's very, very handy. That's about as much about tar that I know, and it's about as much as I think you probably want to know right now, so let's call that segment closed. And let's have a cup of coffee. Why not? Tar and coffee, those go together, right? All right, this is a good cup of coffee. It doesn't taste anything like tar, luckily. But it's about as black as tar, so that's probably a good thing. Hopefully yours is very good. Finish it up, and let's get on with the show. Okay, so we've talked about tarring and unarchiving and stuff like that, and I'd kind of like to switch gears here and want to cover a little bit about file choosers. I think I might have mentioned this once or twice before, but I've done some studies on it, and I'm armed with some dangerous ammunition at this point to talk about file choosers. I also wanted to talk a little bit about CSS because I've been noticing something about a very common misconception, I guess, about CSS, a certain CSS tag that I kind of want to get it out there. I want to talk about it. So we'll do that. But first, let's talk about file choosers. And so the thing about file choosers, right? And by file chooser, I mean the thing that when you tell an application to open a file or to even save a file, then that's the thing that comes up, whatever that is. Like I call it a file chooser because I imagine on my old OS, that's probably what they called it. I'm not really sure why I call it a file chooser, but it does make sense. But you've seen it. You've seen file choosers very frequently. You've seen it in every application you've ever used in which you open a file or save a file. Now, I have very, very frequently thought that file choosers desperately, desperately need work in Linux. And I don't mean their functionality, but I mean their consistency. And I mean, I don't care how laid back you are in your computing environment. I sense that almost anyone is going to be a little bit thrown off if in every application they open, when they go to open a file, which is, I mean, think about opening a file or saving a file. It's something that you do not once, not twice, not 20 times. You do it hundreds of times a day, right? I mean, you open and save files all the time on the computer. That is one of the things that you do on a computer. You are constantly doing that. I mean, unless you're a one-task person who lives in one specific application and you open up one file at the beginning of your day and you save it at the, you know, you save it and then you continue just Control S for the rest of the day. You never see that file chooser again. But more often than not, I'm betting you're seeing a file chooser. It's a huge part of an operating system. It is as big of a deal, I'd say, as the notification issue, which I talked about in seasons past. I don't remember when, but I used to go on and on about notifications, how they would steal focus or they wouldn't steal focus when they needed to steal focus, and how they would pop up onto different areas of the screen, and it drove me crazy. And finally, KDE solved that for me pretty much, for the most part. Not exactly, pretty much. They moved all the notifications, every single notification, they move it up to the little system tray thing. Or down if you keep your kicker at the bottom of your screen like a lunatic. It belongs at the top of the screen. But yeah, so now they all pop up there. So when you get a notification, you know exactly where to look. And there's movement up there, so it catches your eye. You see that little box flash and say, hey, something's going on in some application. Would you like to switch to that application now? Or you can ignore it and it'll go away. It's a beautiful, beautiful system. It was something that needed to happen a long time ago. Just now happened on KDE. Well, not just now. It happened on KDE. I think it might have happened on Unity. And I think it's happened on GNOME 3, and coincidentally, it started to happen very, very recently on another OS that I sometimes encounter. But yes, we definitely beat that OS to that, absolutely. I mean, hugely. It was really, really a problem, I felt. And I feel the same way about file choosers. And file choosers on Linux, I mean, I really think that they're in a horrible state for a couple of reasons. For the experienced user, I think it can throw off your workflow just in that little tiny way, that little things kind of mess you up. You know, it's not like one of those deal breakers where it stops your entire day, it grinds to a halt. It's just one of those things where you stumble a little bit, you know? You're in a different application, you go to open a file, or you go to save a file more often than not, and you think, okay, I'll just create a new directory. And you go to the place where the new directory button usually is, and you stop, and you're like, where's the create a new directory button? Oh, right, I'm in a different framework. Now I have to look elsewhere for the create new folder. And it's not called create new folder, it's called make folder, or whatever, you know? Or it has no label at all, it's just an icon, whatever. So, yeah, really, really annoying. How annoying is it? Well, let's not go into how annoying is it yet. Let's talk about new users, right? New users looking at Linux, you know, you've been there. You've been a new Linux user. They're super critical about everything. Not that we need to do anything to please these new users, but I mean, really, just think back of when you were looking at Linux, still a little bit skeptical, and you see this patchwork thing of like, hey, here's my file chooser. Hey, here's my file chooser. You got, you know, different file choosers for every application. You've got notifications popping up all over the place. You've got different frameworks. GTK never looks quite right because you're in KDE, and KDE never looks quite right because you're in GTK. It's a mess, right? And obviously, with a well-designed distribution or a little bit of knowledge on how to tweak these things yourself, you solve all of those problems, except the file chooser. So how annoying is the file chooser, or how bad is it, I should say? Well, let's count the ways. There is the standard GTK file chooser, right? And you're going to see that in, for instance, GIMP or GPotter, or, you know, pick your favorite GTK application and just think of that file chooser that you get. You know, you've got the certain icon set and the locations, or the places rather, on the left. You've got the name and the size and the date modified in the middle, and then you got the preview pane over on the right. You've got a filter drop down menu at the bottom, and that's kind of what it looks like, and it's got GTK buttons, and that's fine. Then there's the fairly standard KDE file chooser, and you're going to see that in things like Krita or Kate or Kwrite, probably Kdenlive, you know, all the sort of KDE the KDE applications. And that's the one with, again, places on the left, which is nice, and then you've got the main view there in the middle, and then you got some buttons at the top, like you can go back and forward and can go to a parent, you can refresh, you can turn on or off previews, you've got a slider to zoom in or out, you've got a little wrench for even additional functions, you've got some filter things at the bottom, you can filter by file type or by name, and then you've got open and cancel. Similar, not the same, similar. And then you've got weird sort of hybrid KDE file choosers that you'll see in other applications. Specifically, I'm talking about Servicia. I guess that's how you say the name. There's a locations bar on the left. There's like a file tree in the middle. There's no filter bars. There's new folder, okay, and cancel buttons at the very bottom in a row instead of stacked on top of each other. So it's similar, but quite different. And then there's the Qt, the one that comes with Qt itself. And that's, again, a little bit different. And you'll see that in, I think, Qtractor and some other applications that don't necessarily do anything to become, or, you know, they don't tap into the KDE stuff. They're just doing the Qt thing. So again, similar to KDE, but it is different. It isn't KDE. So we're up to like three now, I think, possibly four. Yeah, four. Five, you've got the Java-based file chooser that ships with things like LibreOffice. So that's completely different. You've got some icons up in the upper right-hand corner. You can go to like a new folder, or rather up a folder. You can create a new folder. You can go to your home folder. You got file name, version, file type, read-only options at the bottom, open, cancel, and help buttons in the bottom right. Completely, noticeably different, really noticeably different. And then you've got some more specialized ones. You've got like, I gather they're just from completely different toolkits, like FluidSynth, DSSI for, it's a soft synth that you might be able to use for instance, Qtractor or Ardour. You load a drum kit into this, or a sound font file, and it's a two-pane setup. It's a little bit, I guess, maybe like Midnight Commander, I'm assuming, I've never actually used Midnight Commander, but you have folders on the left and only folders, and then files on the right, and I think it's only the files in there. It's really bizarre. You got new folder, delete file, rename file up at the top. You got a drop down menu for your location in the middle, and an OK and cancel button on the bottom right. Completely different than anything I'd ever seen before. And then there's another one that I'd never seen before with an application called Geeky, G-E-E-Q-I-E. I don't know what this is from. It's again, sort of a two-pane setup. Got a home and a new folder button on the left. It's got sort of a places kind of deal going on the left, but it's completely unique to anything else. And an open and cancel on the bottom right. I think we're up to 6 or 7 now. And then there's a super old one from XMMS. Can't really blame XMMS. They've been around forever, but it's different. I mean, it's a file tree with an OK and a cancel button on the bottom right. And then there's one from XPDF, which is, again, different. It's got, like, this sort of weird filter bar up at the top and some directories on the left and files on the right and an open and a filter and a cancel button at the bottom. I think we're up to 9 now. And granted, a lot of these are sort of, I guess you could say, specialized applications. Although if you're a frequent XMMS user or XPDF user, they're not really specialized at all, are they? They're part of your daily workflow. So what's the solution? Well, the solution, obviously, I imagine, would be abstraction, right? And I know abstraction can be overused, but in a case like this, where the functionality basically is exactly the same, they're all reading from the same data set, right? You go to open a file, you're looking at the same file system, you're looking at the same directory, it's the same task being accomplished. There's really only a set number of things that you can do, to be honest. It just seems like this is a perfect case for abstraction. And by abstraction, I mean give the user somewhere in their setup process or in their system preferences or system settings, wherever you go to define how your system works, give them the option. Maybe read from, and I know I'm talking here instead of programming, but it's just something that I thought of. Maybe someone can make it happen. Maybe not. Maybe it's something that I can work toward. But it seems like if we abstracted it and said, here are the frameworks that this user has installed. And from this list, then, they can choose the file chooser that they want to invoke within any application. So that any application out there can say, I'm going to open a file. And so instead of opening their own file chooser, they can just make a big system call to system, you know, XDG file chooser. And it pops open their choice, whether it's the KDE one or the GTK one or the Java one or the X, you know, whatever XPDF and XMMS are written in, probably Tickle or something, I don't know, or WX widgets maybe, I don't know. Point being, whatever the user is able to call forth, you know, from whatever they have installed on their system, that ought to be the file chooser that they can get. And that, I think, would be a hugely, hugely powerful sort of marketing technique, but also just, it would really help, I think, advanced and new users alike. Because when you have to navigate through a different file system, I mean, file chooser, every time you go to open up a file or save your file, it does throw you off. It just does. It makes you stop, and you have to readjust, and you have to remember, or you have to kind of click that little bit over in your brain that says, okay, I'm not in the KDE thing, I need to readjust, okay, now I'm in GTK, got it, and then you go. But it slows you down just that much. Arbitrarily, it becomes a little bit annoying. I mean, like, if you have less patience for these things, like sometimes I do, I guess, when I'm in the middle of a big project, it starts to grate on your nerves. You start to just kind of get annoyed, because you're like, I'm working in Scribus and in GIMP. And in Inkscape. I don't want there to be a different file chooser for all of these applications. I want them to all be the same file chooser. And it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. It doesn't seem like something that should be a problem. It should be something that we can fix. And I don't think it would be a big deal. I think if I understand how abstraction works, I would imagine it would be something that people could write into their applications, although I'm sure it would probably require people to write it into their applications. I would imagine that would mean that everyone would have to say, yes, we're going to abide by the free desktop spec of file chooser preference. And then we, instead of saying open such and such, we say open free desktop file chooser preference, and that invokes whatever the user has chosen as their file chooser. So I'm sure that would require literally each and every program to be different, but it would be helpful. It would be really neat if that could happen. So that's just a thought about file choosers. It's a problem, I think. People mention it to me. I mean, I notice it when I'm working. Again, mostly when I'm working frantically in Scribus, GIMP, Inkscape, maybe some other application like, I don't know, Font Matrix or something. What I'm doing is that sort of design thing where I've got lots of different applications open and I'm going back and forth and I'm saving one and I'm exporting another and I'm loading it into yet another. You're going through this process and it's just a different file chooser every time. It really does start to get on my nerves. And I just think, why can't we fix this? And I have faith that we can, because I know that we did fix notifications. I mean, that used to be a real issue for me on lots of different places, lots of different OSs, well, too. And it's gotten fixed in my primary OS, Linux. I don't care if it's fixed anywhere else, but it's fixed for me, so I'm happy. So I think the file chooser thing, I think, could be a really cool thing to get fixed, because it would really unify the desktop experience for people. So I don't know. If you know a smart programmer, mention that to them. Otherwise, like I say, maybe that'll be something I can work towards in the future. But we could all work towards it too. Like, let's abstract the file chooser. Really, it needs to be done. Okay, let's talk about CSS. I know I don't talk about CSS that often. I probably should, although I'm not really sure how many of you, my dear listeners, actually do that much HTML and CSS. I don't know. You can let me know if you want. But I don't know. CSS is something that I really enjoy. HTML5 and CSS, for me, have really kind of... I don't know. They've made the web a lot more enjoyable. I mean, they've also made, like, the web a lot... No, they've made the web more enjoyable. It's the rest of the web that's making the web less enjoyable. But HTML5 and CSS themselves, it just really seems, it feels so clean and sleek, and just it seems like everyone, like, it really got fixed with HTML5 and CSS3, I feel. Because I remember trying to learn earlier iterations of HTML. You know, I remember how confusing and bad it was. I mean, really, really recently, like within the time that I have been into geeky things, I was reading about like XHTML, and I'm just thinking, wow, this is absolutely horrible. And it was. I mean, it was bad. But HTML5, beautiful, beautiful thing. And CSS3 makes it even more beautiful. And I don't mean like to look at. I mean, you know, writing it, like the methods behind actually writing the code. It's just really, really cool. The thing about CSS, I feel, is that a lot of people, when we're first learning CSS, and pardon me if you haven't learned CSS, but either way, you might be able to, you may be able to help someone who does CSS by telling them this, because I'm going to kind of expose a function in CSS that is often misused. So, or whatever they're called in CSS, attributes, elements, I don't know, functions. So CSS, I think a lot of times when people learn, and by people, I do mean me, when we learn about CSS, we often learn that in order to get, you know, well, I mean, so let me back up, I guess. So CSS, as you probably might know, does things on kind of, they do them in blocks, right? Like a div becomes like its block. And by default, a div is 100% of the page. When you create a div in your HTML and you render that out in a web browser, give it like a background color or something, and you'll see that it spans the entire portion of that web page. It's 100%. So if you make another div in your HTML, then it will also be 100% of the page, meaning that one comes after the other, right? So if you make a div red and a div blue, then you'll have red across the page and then blue across the page. And that's how divs work. And they're only, by default, I think, if you've got text in them, they're one line high. That's a div. They're a big, flat, long block by default. And you can make them shorter, you can make them smaller, like less wide. You can make them like 50%, but they still see themselves as things that inherit a carriage return. In other words, if you create two divs and make them each 50% wide, then you will still have two divs on two separate lines, and they will only go 50% of the way across the page. Whereas kind of your initial thought would have been, oh, well, then I'll have a red and a blue div, each 50%, filling up one line on my page. That's not how it works. A div assumes that you want a carriage return between, or a blank line, a new line character from, you know, after the first div and before the second div. And there are a couple of elements like that. It's not just the div. It's things like paragraph, the P tag, right? A paragraph, by default, inherits a carriage return, or a new line character, I guess is what we should call it. I don't know. Div H1, H2, H3 lists, the LI elements, OLUL and tables. All of those are, I believe that they are called block level elements, and they're treated as things that kind of by default insist upon getting their own new line. If you remember that, then you'll understand a lot about CSS that a lot of people do not understand about CSS. That's just something to really, really keep in mind. Those elements, div, p, h1, h2, h3, lists like ol, ul, and li, and tables, they're all block-level elements. They all want their own line. That's it. Understand that. And you can even play around with that with really simple HTML. Like, you can generate a super simple HTML document, put two divs into it, open that in a web browser, and you'll see. I mean, as long as you give those divs, like, background colors, you'll see that code it kind of working the way that I just described. They don't sit next to each other ever. Okay, so a problem with CSS, the way that CSS is taught, I guess, is that most people learn from the very beginning that the way to make two block-level elements, like a div or a p or whatever tag, sit next to each other is to float one of those elements, like one of the things, like the divs thing. Just float it. Float lifts something out of what a lot of CSS books seem to call the flow of the document. Unfortunately, I have no idea what they mean by the flow of the document. I don't like terms like that until you really understand them, and then you actually start using terms like that. And unfortunately, I've started using that term, but it is very confusing. But the point is that if you float something, it really takes it out of all the different rules that you've created in your CSS. You know, you've got this whole document of logic and stuff that is dictating how different elements interact with each other in your HTML. And when you float something, it removes it from all of that logic. So you'll do things like you'll float a div, and it takes that div and puts it over onto the left and moves the div after it up to the same line. So you get the two divs on a single line as you wanted. But the problem is that now other things on your page, they don't see that floated div. The text will print underneath that div, or an image will overlap that div. Weird things start to happen when you float things. And there are use cases for floating. You know, there are times that you do want to do that. You do want to take a div or a p tag or an h1 or a ul or an li, and you want to lift it out of all the logic, and you want it to kind of do weird things or be in places that normally an element shouldn't be. But more often than not, I have found people use float when they actually mean display colon inline dash block. So if you, for instance, created a document and you made two divs, one red, one blue, and you made each of those, let's say, 45% wide. So instead of spanning all the way across 100% of the page, your web browser, they'll only go about halfway, a little bit less than halfway, right? 45%. That's to give us some wiggle room. Then if you render that into a web browser, you'll find that they're still on their own separate lines. Now, you could float the first div, like the red div, let's say. You could float that to the left, and that would move, that would keep the red div on one, on the first line, and then it would move the second, the blue div, let's say, up to that first line as well. But that's the wrong way to do it, because it'll screw up the rest of your code. The rest of your HTML won't really know that red div is even there. It doesn't see that. It's floating. Now, you can do fancy things like clearing floats and stuff like that, but it's so much easier, so much cleaner to simply take that red and the blue div, both, and display them as something called inline-block. So display colon inline-block semicolon in your CSS code on both the red and the blue div. So however you're defining those, I just gave them like a div ID equals red, div ID equals blue. Send those both as display colon inline dash block, and then render out the page, and you'll see that the red 45% div is on the first line, and so is the blue one. So what does display inline block do? Well, it removes the inheritance of a new line. That's all it does. It takes your block level element that would normally insist on getting its own line and saying, nope, you're going to display yourself right next to whatever was before you. I don't care if that thing was another div, I don't care if it was a paragraph or a table or whatever, just stay on the same line. And that's really the simplest way to say it. Display inline dash block stays on the same line, whereas not using that insists on that element getting a new line. So if you've got friends into CSS, or if you're exploring CSS yourself, and you're hearing a lot about float and how great it is and how you need to use it, and then you need to do your float clearing and your clear left and your clear both and your clear right and all these other things, don't do it. Chances are you're looking for display colon inline dash block semicolon. And I'm saying this not just as a friend, but as a fellow web designer who likes clean code. I'm just kidding. I'm not actually a web designer. But really, I'm saying it because I myself have run into the problem. I've done it myself a lot. On a couple of my sites, I've already gone through and realized the error of my ways, and I've taken out the floats and put in display inline blocks. It's much, much cleaner, and it is probably what you want to do. You're probably incorrect in thinking that you want to float something. Trust me on this. Floating, it does seem to work, and sometimes, granted, it does work. Like, I mean, there are use cases for it, but more often than not, for me and for some of my friends who I know who do web design a lot, I'll look at their code, or they'll ask me for help or comments, and I'll see that one or two of their design methods have a whole bunch of weird hacks around the fact that they had to float this thing and then add margins and add padding and, you know, move it around like -1 em and stuff like that, because they didn't really want to float it. They actually just wanted to display it as an inline block instead of a new line element, and that fixes everything immediately. It's amazing. I mean, I've had like people gasping in delight from just showing them the inline dash block trick. So remember it for yourself or for any of your friends who do CSS, check it out, look for floats, and see if you can, and see if it would behoove you to change them to display inline blocks, and it might actually make your code a lot easier to deal with if you're experiencing sort of weirdness with some of the things that you're trying to design. So that's a CSS tip for you. That's, I think, about it for this episode. I think the next episode, of course, season 8, episode 20, is the finale. It's this big season finale. We're going to talk about a big, exciting thing that's happening in the world of Linux, a certain distribution. I'm not going to tell you which one. It is not Slackware. That's a little sneak preview. Well, not exactly Slackware. It's not Slacker Media, but it's exciting. It's cool. You will enjoy the next episode, I believe. And until then, enjoy Linux. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or SlackerMedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at NotKlaatu@Jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as NotKlaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, DevRandom, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, I can feel the love. Okay.